Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 221, Zooming Out. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we are here today with a guest who is someone that we have admired from afar for a long time and not really met before, partly because of some of the things that we're going to be talking about on this episode and that we have been talking about, which is geography. Lex's body is in Providence, Rhode Island. My body is in Chicago. And our guest's body is in Los Angeles. And I rarely get out to Los Angeles for whatever reason. So we're excited to have this conversation, which is really enabled and perhaps impelled by the circumstances in which we find ourselves and by the new digital wilderness that we all find ourselves in these days. Our guest today is Stephen Windmuller. He is the Rabbi Alfred Gottschalk Emeritus Professor of Jewish Communal Studies at Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion in Los Angeles. And he's a leading expert on the subject of Jewish politics and the author of a lot of articles looking at the state of the Jewish world today. He writes frequently in a publication, an online publication called E-Jewish Philanthropy, which despite its name, doesn't only cover philanthropy. It has a lot of really interesting articles about, we could call it some of the inside baseball of the Jewish community. And Stephen writes there frequently, and a lot of times I find myself agreeing with it. And one thing that I wanted to just put out there is just that one of the things that I think we have done on Judaism Unbound over the years is called into question certain truisms about generational divides that people talk about in the Jewish community. Sometimes, you know, Lex and I are a generation apart, but we're on the same wavelength a lot. So is it really true that millennials are so different from Gen X? And what I'm really thrilled about is that when we have somebody who is an emeritus professor, that almost by definition suggests a different generation. And your writing, Stephen, is something that I've always been drawn to and felt that, wow, you know, so again, I think these generational divides are not quite right in terms of the way that we classify who thinks what in Jewish life. So I'm really excited to have this conversation with you across now three generations. So Stephen Windmuller, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It is so great to have you here.
Well, thank you to you, Dan, and to Lex for inviting me to be part of Judaism Unbound.
Well, thanks so much. Well, so I thought we could jump in. We were talking a little bit before we started recording about how much are we talking about the virus and how much are we not talking about the virus? And I think that it will be most valuable to sort of tease that out as we talk a little bit about the time before the virus. And, you know, I've been reading your articles for I don't know how many years in E-Jewish Philanthropy. And there have been a few times in the past where, you know, the very few times when I've been coming to Los Angeles where we've tried to get together and weren't able to make it happen. And so, but that was all long before any kind of coronavirus, any kind of physical distancing. And I had felt that you were among the people who were really able to take a look at the Jewish world and the Jewish community and its structures in a clear-headed way and a really helpful descriptive way. And I'm curious if you could share with us just a little bit of the landscape of the Jewish community in America as you have been seeing it over the last few years before the coronavirus happened.
My sense is that much of what we are seeing in sort of real time as a result of the virus really have their antecedents framed in a number of events that have been taking place over the past decades. For example, I honestly believe that the 2008 recession created a good deal of the momentum for the changes we have already begun to see and would trigger a number of new behaviors or responses to how the Jewish community would ultimately be organized and reprioritized. I would partially suggest that there are some generational issues here, and they will be reflected, interestingly enough, by the generations that were directly impacted by 2008 and now by the 2020 coronavirus. I believe that younger American Jews, similar to their probably grandparents and in some cases great-grandparents, were impacted by the 1929 stock market collapse and the Great Recession that followed. There are very distinctive behaviors associated with the generations that came after the 1929 events. And I am making a supposition that some of that behavior, or those types of behaviors, both in economic terms, in organizing and affiliation realities, will also be seen in the context of the events we are now living with. The second factor is that the demographics of the Jewish community have suggested for some period of time that we have infrastructures far larger than what we are able actually to afford, so that part of the downsizing and the culture of merger and collaboration that we both see now and that we began to see already in 2008 are reflective of the demographics of a Jewish community that is smaller, older, and in some measure has also changed as a result of the generational shifts that I spoke about earlier.
There's a way to understand, and I think this is what you're saying, there's a way to understand the Jewish community that we kind of know from the early 21st century as being the product of a bubble that happened perhaps in the mid 20th century, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, that essentially the Jewish institutions were overbuilt because of a set of demographic circumstances, such as moving out to the suburbs and Jews not being so socially welcomed. And so there would then be built all these JCCs and all these synagogues and other kinds of entities that were really there to help Jews find places to be socially. And as soon as that changed and Jews were more welcomed socially in other places, they didn't need all that much anymore. It doesn't mean they didn't need any, but they didn't need as many anymore. And so that there was just a sense that maybe what we're starting to experience is kind of a right-sizing as opposed to some kind of tragedy of disaffiliation.
Dan, you're correct. And I think we can look at the Jewish communal development in three sort of historic phases, certainly from 1880 to 1920. During the mass immigration into the United States of a million Jews from primarily Eastern Europe, we saw the creation of what we would all describe as legacy institutions, those core denominational, cultural, religious, human service delivery institutions that defined the American Jewish scene from the 1920s moving forward. These institutions, as you correctly point out, were adjusted or adapted to the events surrounding the end of the Second World War, the emergence of the State of Israel, and the development of a generation of Jews. I sometimes like to describe the sort of the greatest generation of Jewish leaders and institutional creators who sort of reinvented that model to serve the Jewish community around memorializing the Holocaust, defending and protecting Israel, and ensuring the American dream, the American story, is fully vetted. And that period of the post-Second World War era is really defining that. The third phase of this comes roughly in the mid-1980s with the emergence of so many single issue, institutionally created organizations such as Mazon, the Jewish Response to Hunger, or the Jewish Republican Coalition, or American Jewish World Service. By the way, all three of which were created in 1985. But since 1985, the hundreds of sort of new single issue institutions led and funded and supported by Jewish foundations, by Jewish donors, who saw the need to create alternative ways for younger Jews possibly to find expression and meaning and connection to communal and Jewish religious practice and to the State of Israel. So these three generational or three patterns of evolution have brought us to the 21st century with this sort of mega system of community organizing and advocacy and religious expression.
I think about, for example, the great expansion of the number of Jewish institutions in that mid-century after the Second World War period. And there was a sense that the condition of the Jews is changing. And it feels like not in an organized, centralized way, and maybe that's something to talk about, but there was a massive expansion of the numbers and kinds of Jewish institutions, right? I mean, it wasn't like somebody experimented with some little idea called a JCC. It was like there, all of a sudden there were like dozens of JCCs all over the place, right? And when we think about the Jewish innovation movement of the 21st, the early 21st century, that feels much, much smaller compared to that massive expansion a half century earlier. And I struggle with it in the sense that it feels like my critique to some extent, and it's not a critique of saying that somebody's doing something nefarious. It's a critique in the sense of saying, let me hold up a mirror and I think this is what I'm seeing, is that a lot of what, when fears are articulated in the world of Jewish institutions, I sometimes feel like those fears are more about that our institutions aren't going to make it rather than we're not going to be able to connect with a large number of Jews. Contrast that to an organization that is not one of my favorites, but I do appreciate their approach, which is Chabad, right? Which is out there saying, like, we're on a sacred mission to make sure that every Jew has a chance to connect to Judaism. And I don't particularly gravitate to the kind of Judaism that they're trying to connect people with. So I kind of wish they weren't doing that in the sense that, you know, it's not my cup of tea. But it's fine for them to do it, of course. What I'm wishing is that the sort of more progressive Jewish world would be out there with the same attitude, you know, kind of saying, let's create a Judaism with gravitational attraction. That is the task of our day. In the same way that 50 years ago or more than 50 years ago, the task was to, you know, address the social needs of Jews who are now moving out to the suburbs and were socially lonely. That's like the middle of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, now the task is to build a Judaism that's gravitationally attractive and exciting, because now the task is that people don't have those social needs and they're bored of Judaism and they're not finding anything interesting in Judaism. And so we have to have an almost like, what would it be, like the Kennedy moonshot of, you know, making Judaism compelling. And it just doesn't feel like that's what's driving the decision-making of the Jewish community. It feels that it's much more about an economic fear of loss than the risk of a squandered opportunity of gain.
What has happened is that there was a formal order to the development of Jewish life in the post-war era. It seemed to be driven by the national systems that began to localize, regionalize, and create these on the ground expressions of their ideas and their institutions. What has occurred in the latter part of the 20th century and is reflected in the general culture as well is a kind of distribution economics where this $10 billion Jewish enterprise, and that's what some economists believe we might really describe as really the Jewish model today, is built around the vision and wisdom and insights of particular donors and funders who are not in lockstep with one another or with a central agenda. But what we have is really this let many flowers bloom phenomenon. And that has created, as a result, the distribution and the spread of these extraordinary models and different expressions of Jewish creativity and religious participation, but certainly not with a kind of central vision of what this might look like, who it ought to serve, and what are the sort of measures of success and evolution. You point to Chabad, and I wrote in 2012 a piece in Jewish Philanthropy and elsewhere called Unpacking Chabad and taking a look at a number of the factors that contributed to why it is such a success story with its 4,000 operatives across the world, its ability to, in a sense, create an imagery of its being an authentic or the authentic Jewish expression. And what can we learn, the 10 principles that I cited in that article, about what we might learn from this extraordinary direction and invention, in a sense, of how Chabad took its model and built it as a worldwide system. And I believe that that is an interesting model actually to look at because of the effectiveness of what it has achieved and how many other institutions in some measure are drawing upon what they have learned or understood to be the dynamics of that system.
I'm curious to get your take on a dynamic that just generally frustrates me in sort of the Jewish press and in Jewish communal conversations. There seem to be these camps of people publishing articles, talking in synagogues or in JCCs or in any kinds of institutions, whatever, or even just in conversations with friends, where the back and forth seems to be either, oh my gosh, Jewish institutions are dying, this is a terrifying time, affiliations down, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is, you know, we've lost so much and people used to be more knowledgeable and now they're apathetic. That's like one camp. Okay. Other camp seems to be, how dare you? This is actually the greatest time of all time to be Jewish across every era and context. This is amazing. I am, you know, somebody who loves the digital ecosystem, but like we've got the digital world now. People are able to be in touch in ways they never could before. Like this is in so many ways the only time that so many Jews who are engaging would ever have engaged in the way that they are. Previous eras, they couldn't have done that. Wow. We all love to think that whatever time period we live in is the most X or the least X, but I'm not actually convinced that that's the case. So like, help me out. Like what actually, as opposed to like, you know, we are the best, this is the best era for this, the worst era for that. Like what's strong right now? When you think about the scope of the last few generations of Judaism, both your own personal experience and your scholarship, your all of the learning you've done, like, what right now really is exciting and a form of Jewish engagement or learning or participation that is thriving in a way that maybe isn't unprecedented, but hasn't recently been precedented? And on the other hand, what things are there to be concerned about? Are there elements of Jewish life that might be weaker now than a decade ago or a generation ago or a century ago? Like, how can we wade through those questions without necessarily jumping to, we're the most, we're the least, we're the best, we're the worst?
I think we have to look at some of the really interesting factors that sort of frame why people are sort of moving to one camp or the other. First of all, this is the first generation in which we have such extraordinary wealth in the Jewish community to experiment and to grow some of the models that we have seen. People have far more choice in terms of the ways by which they express Judaism. Yes, historically, there were different camps and there were different ideas about Jewish living and culture and language and value, but those are minimal compared to the kinds of diversity of thought and potential practice that Jews have in the 21st century. I also believe that this is a unique moment in certainly the American Jewish story because it has permitted Jews who are not necessarily in leadership roles or who have titles to be able to define and articulate for themselves particular streams of thinking and practice and action. And that is a very different story than what might have been the historic model of the sort of rigidity of community that we saw evolve in the 19th and early 20th century. Yes, there are some issues we need to be concerned about, but there are also some extraordinary opportunities which we also need to take advantage of. There isn't a Jewish community today, and I think we need to sort of break the sort of imagery that one people, one destiny is somehow still a slogan and a framework for how the community sees itself and operates. In reality, American Jews are self-defining their Jewish journey. And the second reality is that there are the resources available to sort of permit and generate these sort of different expressions. And that's an extraordinary place to find ourselves. I do worry that intermarriage, issues associated with misreading or misunderstanding this diversity of community or communities, has led some American Jews to sort of create an orthodoxy of expectation and expression. Should you or should you not be defined as Jewish or Jewishly committed? I worry that that kind of orthodoxy of language and expectation is highly problematic and is also a clear turnoff to some folks who simply will walk away from institutions that sort of create these definitional boundaries. So I think we do face some of these larger issues of being now fourth and fifth generation American, and that by the definition of who we are as Americans suggests we carry multiple identities. And our Jewish soul, our Jewish peace, is but one of the several identity packages that I think American Jews are today blessed to own. And we have to sort of understand those realities up against this maturing or changing of generations and culture.
I'd love to dive a little deeper into what you brought up around folks, not just those who are, you know, quote unquote leaders, not just those who have titles, and how this is a moment where not just those at the helm of institutions have a really significant impact. So I guess what I would love to hear from you is just a little more about that. Like, what is happening with some of these dynamics whereby people who aren't just at the center, people who don't have, you know, graduate degrees in Jewish studies, Jewish education, rabbi, cantor, what's happening that is allowing them to play a sufficient role? And I guess I'll add, like, to the extent that there are still obstacles, hurdles, barriers that are setting sort of a ceiling on what those people are able to achieve, how might we conceptualize those and how might we approach that?
Part of the response here is actually the changing character of Jewish professionals and of rabbis in particular. We are seeing today a fourth of the American liberal rabbinic world, that is conservative, reform, reconstructionist rabbis, playing roles outside of the American synagogue. And that number will continue to expand as they become chaplains and teachers, as they take on roles with in the nonprofit sector, in community and civic organizations, as they play roles in other settings. Because the Jewish world itself, on the definitions that we've been talking about, have so rapidly and rather radically changed. The second outcome of this has to do with the fact that authority in the Jewish community has shifted from the world of the rabbinate, the world of community organizational press statements and other sort of expressions of the voice of communal authority or communal control. That has shifted to the sovereign self, to the individual's own ability to define what he or she will accept as messaging and as institutional truths, if you wish. This capacity of individuals to stipulate their terms for participation and connection to anything larger than themselves. And part of it is reflected in the fact that they are articulating by their support and their personal practice, their own messaging of what constitutes Jewish life and Jewish belief and Jewish advocacy. Every Jewish institution today almost has a shadow government. So if AIPAC is seen as the central voice of the Jewish connection to Israel, then J Street and other expressions are seen as the backbenchers And I think we see some of those same parallels or behaviors elsewhere in our system, as even in the denominational Jewish world, in religious expression, you have the affiliated with the formal systems of the Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, and Orthodox worlds. And then you have this array of unaffiliated, independent institutions and minyanim that are expressing themselves on their terms. Authority is being challenged, and the capacity to create shadow regimes or institutions is a reflection of some of these pieces.
Your description makes me think about another shadow. Like, I actually think there are two shadows. There's the sort of shadow government. What do they call it in England? They have the whole government. The opposition has a whole government set up.
Yes.
You know, kind of in exile. Both of those are in the system. You know, so this one says, well, the conservatives have gotten the reins of power, so we're going to set up a liberal alternative government in waiting, this kind of thing. And maybe, you know, at some point the tables will turn and we'll be elected. And then it'll be reversed. I almost feel like there's this other shadow, which is folks like us, but it's really the people who are saying, you know, none of this stuff matters, or it matters to a very small number of people. And this is where I think the coronavirus situation might start to come in a significant way, because especially if this lasts much longer, and I'm not even saying it has to last for 2 years. I'm saying even if this situation lasts for 4 months, which it seems pretty clear that it will, I think that the institutions are going to be very surprised at how many people don't come back, and that may be because they have realized that I didn't really feel close to that institution anyway. That's sort of how I feel about like coffee shops, right? Because I've been making coffee at home and really liking it a lot more. And like, why should I go to a coffee shop anymore after this? I bought all the stuff at home. I have it at home now. I don't need to do that. And I wonder how many people are going to have that response. And then also just that they're going to have found, that they're going to have found something really exciting online. That, and it might be something that's digital, or it might be something that's just there in LA, but this is in New York and they can access it digitally, you know, but they found a place that's more exciting to them than the institution from which they came. If that description is right, or there's some kind of description like that is right, then the virus is devastating to the world of institutions in a much bigger way than I think anybody is thinking about, because even these funds that are there to try to help the institutions weather the storm, imagine that on the other end of the storm, they'll be back. And I don't think they're going to be back, or I think they'll come back and then they'll quickly merge or go out of business because they're not going to have enough people. And the thing that I want to make the connection to everything that you're saying is that I'm looking around in this digital wilderness where we are now, and we're part of it, but there's also a lot of other small organizations that I think are doing incredible work online, you know, and that they're being incredibly successful, and their budget is like close to nothing. And there are these organizations out there with multi-million dollar budgets that are almost doing nothing. And it's kind of hard to conceptualize how on the other end of this, that is a situation that makes sense anymore. And I wonder that to the extent that it does, are we now going to have this all the same institutions that we had before the coronavirus? It's just serving a lot fewer people. And at what point is somebody, whether it's funders or somebody else, going to say, like, this doesn't make sense anymore? Like, we actually are in a situation again like the 60s and 70s where there's a massive, or even think about the Russian migration or these massive movements that at some point they're massive enough where somebody says, hey, you know what? We have to do something in a massive way. And we're going to have to reorient the entire way that all of our resources are deployed because the way that they have been deployed just makes no sense. And I guess I'm wondering again, I'm saying it in a kind of extreme and ungenerous way, but I'm curious if you could help us, you know, from the perspective of a political scientist, of somebody who really, you know, looks at these trends to say, like, am I wrong and there's actually another way to look at it, or am I right maybe saying it a little too extremely, but help me, you know, put a little bit of academic meat on these bones.
There is an existing debate currently going on, not just in the Jewish world, but in the sort of the social science world, of whether this type of moment will generate or regenerate the idea of community. I mean, we're Robert Putnam in the 1990s talked to us about bowling alone and the disengagement of community and of the civic order. There's an argument today that we may see the rebirth of community. Now, in what shape and form may tie into some of your observations about institutions and their status. We'll come back to that in a moment. The other interesting conversation is about religious revivalism. There were periods in American history in which the Jewish community benefited from religious revivalism. After the Civil War, it is therefore not surprising that you see the birth of Reform Judaism and then to quickly be followed by Conservative Judaism and then the American world of Jewish Orthodoxy in sort of three decades of the 1870s, 80s, and 90s of the 19th century, where we saw this explosion of Jewish religious organizing, but also within Protestantism and within the Catholic world as well. So the question has been raised, are we about to see a religious revival in America? So those two sit at the top of this sort of conversation, but underneath it, we see the discourse around the very issues you pose. So are organizations preparing for what is about to happen? In some cases, there is a reality already well underway, way before this moment, that memberships in synagogues and JCCs, Federation Giving, and in other indices of measure that we saw dropping numbers. Will this expand that? Will this, you know, sort of implode the communal system further? And we would see the closure or mergers or ending of certain types of services. I am aware of a number of synagogues at this point that are actually already in conversations about either merging or changing some of the core sort of principles or guidelines by which they have operated. So that is a factor on the ground for institutions. The way federations, as an example, or the way some of our community advocacy groups were organized will not be the system or model for moving beyond this point, that the fundamental reconfiguration of how one talks about community organizing and community organizational life. I saw a strategic plan yesterday of a particular JCC, and it raises all these reality checks of what needs to be addressed and what are the possibilities here. Will people return? And if they don't return, are there ways to engage them differently? And part of the conversation as experienced in that document and in others is, all right, we've seen this extraordinary growth in the last 4 to 6 weeks of the use of technology, of Zoom, this extraordinary amount of information, of programming. We've seen groups, whether they are what we would call traditional or legacy organizations or startups, doing some marvelous teaching and interventions to sort of keep in touch with community so that the virtual Jewish community may become much more a core element to anything that we see happening beyond the virus and beyond these moments in time. So I think that this is a tipping point. The question is, what will be the character of it? That is, the dimensions of how much will be returning to institutional and the corporate model of Jewish life, and how much will actually be applied from this moment to the continued evolution and development of Jewish expression and creativity.
I really love that you brought us back to the late 1800s. I like that for a bunch of reasons. I think that what you were talking about with, you know, the different movements, one arising 1870s and 1880s, 1890s, I think potentially it could teach us a lot. And I want to throw out one thing that Dan and I have been talking about lately, which is we've been thinking about this digital moment, but it's more than a moment, but this digital ecosystem of Judaism that has been in the process of arising for a few decades now, but is accelerating. We've been thinking about it as a kind of migration. And the reason why I like that we're talking about the late 1800s is because that coincides with the beginning of the most famous of recent history Jewish migrations, which was a huge influx of folks to the United States. And what Dan and I have talked about is, like, it became very clear very quickly, and we can see that from the rise of these new movements, that the Judaisms that would arise in America were not going to be the same Judaisms that existed, whether it's in Europe or in other places that people were immigrating from. And so there needed to be new institutions to fit the context that they were in. And then, you know, over a long time, over that entire first two phases that you outlined, more and more institutions came into being with different models, et cetera. So I guess what I would ask you is, do you see us in an analogous moment to that late 1800s, early 1900s moment? Do you think that what's happening with the growth of digital Judaism is similar? Do you think that this migration metaphor, whereby we're sort of entering into a really new context where there will need to be new models, new structures, do you think that works? Would you critique it in any way? I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Lex, I actually think that you may have hit upon something that is not yet sort of formalized in the minds of, let's say, the academic world, but certainly in the mindset of people such as yourself who think about these questions of how do you place what's happening into some context, into historical models or into trends that we see in the broader society. And I'm not certain we can call the shot today, meaning that we can say this is definitively the moment of either a new wave or a kind of immigration or migration status. But I think there are maybe four sort of elements we have to look at that will help shape some of the ideas that you're at least thinking about and that may have some cachet or value to thinking and playing upon. The first of these four is certainly anti-Semitism. I think we need to understand what it is today, how it is impacting Jewish life, how it impacts the culture and social life of the society, because the sort of the politics of hate has become, unfortunately, a deeply ingrained sort of practice or pattern we see in daily discourse, and that has to be troubling. And what is the specific impact on anti-Semitism on Jews and how Jews respond? Or do they migrate? Do they feel that they're uncomfortable living in a society in which the Pittsburghs, the Charlottesvilles, the Poways, or other such sort of moments are increasingly becoming a kind of mantra of social behavior or social ideas? The second principle here is technology. So do we become worshipers or practitioners totally around the new technologies, as seeing this is sort of the gateway to new Jewish expression? Or is it simply a piece of a much larger picture of really changing values, practices, priorities that people have initiated? The third element has to do with the economy. I think that we will be in a very different economy as an outgrowth of this expression or experience, and we have to understand what that may be telling us in terms of whether or not what we have seen over the last 10 years with millennials in terms of their inability to really break into the marketplace as fully and as completely as their parents' generation, and to have the kind of income streams that would keep them in a sense as competitive as generations before them? And will that change the sort of luster of the United States and its promise of being the golden Medina to be potentially a problem for new generations who are going to be trying to figure out the American economic picture? And the fourth of these streams is sociological. The reality that we are a very divided class society, the very well-to-do, including a significant number of American Jews, and a society of have-nots, also including a number of of Jews, especially coming out of this experience, who will have seen some of their valued capacity as producers and as owners and as resource people diminished by the economy's devastation on professional classes, on small business, on the nonprofit sector, and what that will do to change choices that people make in terms of affiliation, participation, and engagement, because they will have fewer resources and dollars to distribute to the economy of the third sector, the nonprofit and religious worlds. So these ideas, as large as they are, but as significant as they are, may be the definers of what we see coming out of the coronavirus: technology, the social and economic realities, and the impact of anti-Semitism.
Maybe in our closing minutes, I could just ask you to spin that forward a little bit in terms of implications for whoever you want to talk about. But I'm thinking about the Jewish professional class today, particularly thinking about rabbis as one example. But, you know, I'm thinking about migrations, which are often turn out to be a net positive for the lower class people who migrate. But there may be reasons like anti-Semitism that, for example, Russian doctors might immigrate to the United States, but they can't be a doctor anymore. And they can't, I don't know if they made that much money in Russia when they were a doctor, but they had more prestige. But here they are making maybe less money and certainly less prestige. And I'm thinking about those, that's a negative reason. I'm also thinking about the early days of the State of Israel when there were people making aliyah for ideological reasons. And there too, a doctor might have ended up as a you know, farm hand at the kibbutz, you know, and that there are times in migrations where the professional class of the previous landscape can't continue in those roles. But I guess I'm asking, like, you know, it seems pretty clear to me that we can't retain the number of organizations that we've had, which means there'll be fewer jobs at high paying salaries. And even within those jobs, I wonder if they'll be able to continue to pay high paying salaries. And, you know, I work in this sector of the Jewish economy that pays extremely low salaries, but we have a lot of fun, you know, and we feel like we're really doing that early foundation laying. But I wish that I could kind of recruit some folks from, you know, from the rabbinate to come over and work over here, but we can't pay them a shadow of what they're making over there. And so the question, I guess, is what do you see in terms of the reorientation of the Jewish economy, so to speak, in terms of people? What will happen?
It turns out that the Pew study on the American Jewish community is underway now. That is, as you'll recall, the 2013 Pew report was profoundly important to our community. And there is a second one now in the field, in play. And we may learn a great deal of data from people's reactions and perceptions about themselves, the community, and Jewish life, and the economy, in a sense, from that. The second will be that November of 2020 certainly will be a testing ground to see how Americans in general, and Jews in particular, are coming out of this experience and what that is going to reflect in the political choices we make. And that's beyond the presidency. It involves city and state officials. It's a referendum on the experience and on the job well done or not well done by those in governance and in power. The third will be the census. It will be coming to us in the early part of next year, and we will begin to get a greater sense of the health and viability of the society in many different ways. I think in the short term, for sure, and this may become ultimately the pattern, we will see the downsizing of the American rabbinate. And this is not a news story. I think the rabbis themselves acknowledge and realize that there will be radical and immediate changes to their profession and to the Jewish communal professional class as well. And the larger issue will be whether or not the marketplace in general will be able to turn around more rapidly to employ the hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of folks who will not be able to return to the positions that they previously held, or that will be working on a reduced income and partialized salaries and functions. So the immediate fallout will be particularly difficult. I expect that we may well see some civil disorder and violence in this country, as people are frustrated and may become very frustrated over the inability of a divided Congress, for example, to be responsive to what are felt and necessary needs. I think that food and shelter become the very first issues of measure of how a society governs itself. Will our people be fed? And will there be adequate and secure housing? And then the third level of that, of course, will be, is there a kind of vision for the marketplace? You know, will there be jobs and what kinds of jobs? So the portfolio for the next 6 months is particularly uncertain and could be particularly volatile. And I think that we will be measured, that is, the society will be measured, not so much by how well we did during the coronavirus, but how well we help our society, and in the case of our conversation this at this time, really about how the Jewish community is able to help itself and to prepare itself for the steps that will be necessary to sort of move through this without a huge amount of disruption, and allow for people to find ways to reconnect, and for professionals to be held with respect in terms of finding ways to engage them in maybe new ventures that will be necessary for what comes next.
Well, we're going to close on that note. Thank you so much, Stephen Windmuller, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you very much.
All right. And thank you to all of you out there listening. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of Judaism Unbound Live. We hope that you'll check out future episodes. Reminder that if you're listening to this on audio, you can tune in live with video. And you can do that at the jewishlive.org website or on our Facebook page, which is just Jewish Live, all one word. We love it. Dan and I love it when you are in touch with us with any questions, ideas, comments, really anything that you want to send our way. And you can do that through any of the following mechanisms. One is our Facebook page, or two Facebook pages, Jewish Live, all one word, and Judaism Unbound, two separate words. Another is our website, judaismunbound.com or jewishlive.org. A third is our Twitter feed, at Judaism Unbound. And last but not least, there's our emails, which are dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we like to make is that any amount of financial donation that you can send our way is greatly appreciated, and you can do that via jewishlive.org/donate or judaismunbound.com/donate. So thank you so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound Live.